There's no question this is going to be one of the Herculean tasks in city building, in place building for the 21st century.
Ukraine's cities have been shattered. When reconstruction begins, what should we rebuild first? And what should we rebuild differently?
Welcome to What's Next for Ukraine. This is the second in a three-part series inspired by the research presented at the Winter Conference of Economic Policy, Papers on European and Global Issues. I'm Tim Phillips.
Reconstruction isn't only about replacing homes and roads. It's a once-in-a-generation chance to fix what didn't work before the war, while avoiding costly mistakes made under pressure. In this episode, I'm speaking with Ed Glaser of Harvard, Martina Kirchberger of Trinity College Dublin, and Andrei Parkomenko of USC about where the biggest gains and the biggest risks lie in rebuilding Ukraine's urban infrastructure.
...90% of housing units were constructed before 1990. Most of the housing stock is from the Soviet Union.
Andrei, before the war, how big was Ukraine's population? Was the population rising?
So Ukraine's population was declining even before the war. It was over 50 million in the 90s. Then right before the war, it was about 41 million. And during the war, more than 6 million people left the country.
Was that population concentrated in the cities? Did the cities have a strong attraction in Ukraine?
Yeah, Ukraine is quite urbanized. About 65 or 70% of population live in cities.
And the sort of housing that Ukraine's cities have, what sort of stock was it? Was it still from the Soviet era?
One striking fact about Ukraine is that 90% of housing units were constructed before 1990. Most of the housing stock is from the Soviet Union. One exception is Kyiv, which has a lot of new housing.
One thing to really remember about the urban structure for Ukraine is the extent to which Kyiv bestrides the nation like an urban colossus, right? Per capita GDP, by one estimate, is four times the national average. It's the only big city that's actually rising between 2001 and 2021. This is not uncommon globally. We think of Jakarta, we think of London, right, as these sort of superstar cities that really soar. But it's a really striking phenomenon of the Ukrainian situation, only made more extreme by the fact that there are shadows over the east.
And how well were its cities working before the war?
One issue with Ukrainian cities is that a lot of infrastructure comes from the Soviet Union. Ukrainian cities were naturally built for cars. Even though they are not big by global comparisons, they are among most congested cities in the world. For example, Kyiv and Lviv are among top 40 of most congested cities in the world, despite not even being among top 100 cities by population.
I mean, there's beauty there. There's wonderful old bones of the city, but there still is so much investment that needs to happen to make them places of consumption and functionality like they could be.
This reconstruction, I imagine this is going to be a very big project. How big will it be and how long is it going to take?
According to the World Bank estimates, at the end of 2024, just the physical damage was around $175 billion. We suspect it's probably over $200 billion by now, close to the end of 2025. And this will be a very long-run reconstruction project. It will take a lot of years.
You know, there are estimates that go even higher. There are estimates that are, you know, $500 billion. There are estimates that are over $1 trillion. But I think it's almost implausible to imagine that amount. But there's no question this is going to be one of the Herculean tasks in city building, in place building for the 21st century.
When you do a rebuilding program like that, I would imagine that it cannot be in any way haphazard. You have to use data to work out what you're going to build and where you're going to build it. What data is available to do that? What can you use?
One data that we use in our project to understand where is optimal to rebuild is to look at how Ukrainian economy was developing before the war. And what we see before the war is that there was a substantial shift of economic activity from south and east towards the center and the west, meaning that economic activity shifts away from heavy industry, from mining, from proximity to Russia, more towards services, more towards EU, more towards the west. And this kind of data suggests that it is possible to make a case that we should concentrate at least a sizable amount of rebuilding efforts towards supporting this reallocation of the economy towards the West.
Yeah, because there is also the question of whether you rebuild where the planners think it might be most efficient to rebuild, or whether you rebuild where people want to live and have decided that they want to be. How do you make that decision?
You know, I've always been a big fan of freedom. And as the people of Ukraine are currently fighting a war for their liberty, I think the basic principle should be that they get to live where they want to live. That being said, infrastructure needs to go somewhere. And there need to be decisions made, and we need to be reasonably sensible about where we put that infrastructure, where the Ukrainian people puts that infrastructure. But that being said, ultimately, it has to be about individual autonomy and the freedom of the Ukrainian people to choose their own destiny.
As Andrei pointed out, there are a lot of Ukrainians outside the borders of Ukraine at the moment. Will they return? Will they need housing when they do return?
According to the surveys, a lot of people would like to return. Not everybody will return.
No.
And when people do, I guess the question will be, where do they want to settle? I definitely see that a lot of people who left eastern and southern areas that are currently damaged and not as livable as other parts of Ukraine, they will not be the places where people necessarily want to return. And we definitely need more housing supply in places like Kyiv, in places like Lviv, Uzhgorod, other cities in the West.
With rebuilding costing so much, of course, a major policy goal is to build as efficiently as possible, minimize the cost of rebuilding. There are all sorts of choices that have to be made here. What is the argument for giving the work to Ukrainian firms? I mean, that would help rebuild the economy, or allowing foreign firms, especially the ones that have experience in building at scale, to do this rebuilding work?
So there's a clear trade-off here. Giving work to Ukrainian firms allows them to recover after a sharp drop in demand and to take advantage of the reconstruction activity that's going to take place and create employment for their workers. On the other side, having global contractors be involved also has the potential to create spillovers in terms of technology, in terms of management practices, and if we look at the industrial organization of the sector, currently there are about 80% of firms have 10 or fewer workers. Ah. And there are only 7 large firms with more than 250 workers. So it's not extremely plausible that all of these big scale projects can be constructed by domestic firms. And there's sort of a midway to having global firms enter and do some of these big projects and subcontract some of these activities to local firms.
There are a lot of people who may be demobilized. Pretty soon, there will be returning Ukrainians, maybe looking for jobs as well. What are the arguments for giving them the building jobs or for inviting foreign workers who have experience in doing this?
One of the strategies to reduce the cost of reconstruction is openness, and that means increasing the number of workers and firms that are available for reconstruction. And that means employing workers that are available domestically, but as well potentially bringing in foreign workers. So that is a balance that will have to be decided at a local level.
Could this be an opportunity in Ukraine to develop skills, retrain a post-war workforce?
It clearly can. One of the strategies is investing in investing that comes out of a literature of resource-rich countries that are scaling up their investment. And this was coined by Paul Collier and refers to investments that can be taken in advance of the scaling up of capital. And one strategy of investing in investing is increasing the number of skills in the population that are useful for reconstruction. And so there is scope for the government to work with educational institutions and building companies to think about training programs that are covering skills that will be needed. And they could also work with global contractors to be able, once the reconstruction starts, provide these skills in the local population. The other reform that can also be considered earlier on already is making labor markets more flexible so that firms can more nimbly hire workers for these construction projects.
Openness and investing are sort of crucial parts of rebuilding, in our view. In some sense, though, the skills are naturally going to come about because of learning by doing. We just need to go into this recognizing that there are going to be a lot of screw-ups early on, and things are going to get better as we move forward. But I do want to stress that loading too many objectives on one task is always unwise. I come from a country in which the average transit agency spends $1.05 million per electric bus. You can buy a perfectly nice electric bus from Hyundai for $350,000. Some part of that is, of course, because we're trying to do lots of things, as well as buying electric buses. We're trying to buy American. We're trying to encourage industry in different ways. We're trying to do lots of things. The result of that is we have buses that are ridiculously expensive, and subways that are ridiculously expensive, and roads that are ridiculously expensive. And I think it really makes sense to focus on the through line of, you know, we're trying to provide as much sensible infrastructure as inexpensively as possible for the Ukrainian people. And I think on top of that, you want sort of a human capital strategy about investing in the Ukrainian people. But in some sense, that should be a separate objective and not part of the minimizing costs objective.
We have some experience in Europe of post-war reconstruction and these sort of rebuilding projects. Do we have examples of successes and failures from the past?
For sure. Although, blessedly, the more recent examples are typically not in Europe. So, for example, we think of the rebuilding of central Beirut by the Solidaire Company, which was very centralized, as being, in some sense, both a physical success. I mean, it's beautiful. It's a very nice high-end mall. But it's very hard to see how that actually serves the purposes of ordinary Lebanese. And it was sort of a structure that was built for the structure's sake. It certainly enriched the Solidaire shareholders. But it wasn't done in a way that enabled the autonomy of ordinary Lebanese. By contrast, I want to take you not to post-war Berlin or post-war Warsaw, but rather to post-war Tokyo, which was absolutely devastated. Firebombing was absolutely cataclysmic. Mm-hmm. And the city was really remarkably rebuilt. What's really notable about its rebuilding is how decentralized it was. There were master plans. They were fairly quickly abandoned, and by and large, local communities just figured it out. There's an amazing Japanese strategy, which is land readjustment, which enables the owners of small lots to come together and combine them in large lots. There are protections against abuse because a supermajority of the landowners need to vote. And then they exchange houses in the new properties versus for their space in the old properties. Tokyo is one of the more amazing examples to look at on this. And it's a great example just because it did not involve top-down overplanning, but involved empowerment from the bottom up.
There's been a lot in the news recently about problems of corruption in Ukraine. There's going to be a lot of money in this post-war reconstruction. How do we make sure that we minimize any potential corruption problems?
So procurement, the spending of public money, is one of the classic avenues towards corruption. It's where cash leaves the system, and so it's the place that cash gets filtered. There are multiple ways of thinking about how you're going to fight corruption. One of the reasons why we like standardization, meaning that you buy the bus from Hyundai, you don't commission your own separate bus, or you buy your drones on Amazon, you don't have a lengthy procurement process, is that it's just so much more transparent. Having a system which says, okay, you've got to go out and buy these things. We know what the market price is. Show us your receipts. There's much less scope for there to be corruption. When you do have bespoke products being made, there's typically a trade-off between how much autonomy you want to give the procurement entities, the agents of the government, and how much you want to restrict them. The upside of autonomy is they can be nimble, they can adjust to things. The downside is they can be corrupt. You've got to adjust that scale depending upon where you think you are. Ukraine is in a relatively good position on this because they've been fighting corruption and fighting it well for the last years. In fact, you know, the recent scandal that's come about in many ways should be seen as being a triumph of the fact that Ukraine is now fighting corruption, not a sign that things are getting worse. Yeah. But the more that we have ways of checking what are the bank accounts of government officials, what are the earnings of government officials, what's the spending of government officials, and those tools are already coming into place, right? Those are additional weapons for fighting corruption. So again, standardize, to think about the right level of trade-off between autonomy and regulation of the government entities. Do what you can to view everything about the government's officials' cash. Remember, in Singapore, you didn't need to prove corruption. All you needed to prove is the person had too much money. That was enough in terms of the government. It was very effective in banishing corruption from Singapore.
And I think in terms of public procurement, Ukraine is already in a very strong position, having put in place systems that have won prizes and are more advanced than some of what advanced economies have. That should give them a strong place to enter this reconstruction period.
We only get one chance to get this right. What do we need to know? What would we like to know to be able to get it right?
So I think there are a number of open questions that we can't answer and that are key. For example, the sequencing of reconstruction, what type of infrastructure we would want to prioritize, how we can capture things like delays, coordination failures, and what are the sectors we should target.
The war, unfortunately, is still ongoing. We don't know how it will end. And what exactly we do in terms of reconstruction will depend on how the war ends, where the border will be, on which conditions do we settle the war.
I want to make a pitch for constant learning. You're right in some sense that we only have one chance to get this right, but it'll be a long process. We will constantly get feedback. And what we have to do going into this is to have the humility to learn, not to think that we've gotten all the answers going in, but to recognize every day there's going to be a flow of new data that's going to inform us. What I really hope is that we constantly approach it with that openness and we never let the future be the prisoner of the past.
Let us hope that it does go well and let us hope that it starts soon. Ed, Martina, Andre, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
The paper is called Rebuilding Ukraine's Cities, Maximizing Benefits and Minimizing Costs by Edward Glaser, Marina Kirchberger, and Andriy Parkomenko. Published in the current issue of Economic Policy, Papers on European and Global Issues. And that issue is titled, What's Next for Ukraine? Next time on What's Next for Ukraine, after the fighting stops, another challenge begins. Getting people back into work, including demobilized soldiers, without breaking the labor market that kept the country going.
This was a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer was Megan Bieber, and the sound editor was Andrei Zargarian.